I'd like to introduce our speaker for today, who will speak until 10:10, and will then answer any questions from the audience. Let's all welcome Lee from Costa Mesa. Good luck.
Welcome. My name's Lee. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be here this morning. Grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's an honor to be asked to come and speak before your group, and you know, it's good to be here, man. It's good to be alive today. Grateful to be sober. You know, before I get too much into my story, I just want to say welcome to the newcomers or anyone that identified as new. I mean, welcome to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you don't have to take a drink again, even if you want to. You know, that's what I learned here. So, once again, my name's Liam, an alcoholic. I say Costa Mesa. I actually live in the city of Orange, so this is kind of a local meeting for me. But I probably spend more time in the city of Costa Mesa than anywhere else in Orange County. There's a little place down there called Charlie Street that I spend a lot of time working with other alcoholics. I spend quite a bit of time there. And that's makes up a big part of my recovery. I'm a gallon-a-day cheap vodka drinker. Does anyone know what Barton's Vodka is? Yeah. Anyone familiar? Yeah. Usually some hands go up. It's usually like how I know. If you don't know what Barton's is, basically there's a shelf of vodka. There's you know, at the liquor store there's, you know, shelves and stuff like that, and there's the shelf of the cheap stuff, and then underneath that is where you'll find the Barton's. It's usually on the bottom. I think last time I checked it was like $8.99 for a half gallon or something like that. It comes in the plastic bottle because you don't want the glass ones because they break too easy when you drop them. Usually what I do when I get a half gallon of vodka is I'll pull that stupid plastic thing out of there, you know, that they put in there for, I don't even know why they put that in there. It's for like shot glasses or something like that. I never use the glass. I drink straight out of the bottle, you know. I like it a half gallon at a time. I take the cap off, throw the cap away because that's for transportation purposes only. When I'm drinking, I'm not going anywhere. Not going anywhere. Like to get a half gallon, go back to my apartment, lock the door. Mind you, I live alone. Lock the door and drink myself till I pass out, you know, and the whole time, and this is just part of the delusion, the whole time I'm telling myself I'm having a good time, this is fun, this is great, you know, not hurting anyone, I'm only doing this to myself, partying. It's not much of a party when you're sitting there alone drinking yourself till you black out, you know, but that's just how I roll. It didn't start out like that. I started drinking heavily when I was about 18 years old. I was born and raised out here in Orange County, lived down in Lake Forest till the time I was about 18 years old, and, you know, I really didn't start drinking heavy till I turned 18. I lived with my father at the time. He moved out to Houston, Texas. He worked for Boeing. He was on the space station project for like 12 years. The guy's a genius. He's a rocket scientist. My sister's in medical school. I'm an alcoholic. Don't know how that happened. That's just the way it happened. So he moved out to Houston, Texas when I was 18. I tried staying out in California, ran out of money, ran out of resources because I'm, you know, running and gunning right off the bat. You know, I got kicked out of high school sophomore year for sales, possession, and transportation of some outside issues, which I won't really get into. But basically, I dropped out as a sophomore, started working, doing my own thing. You know, a lot of people said, you need to go back to school, you know, you need to go to college, you need to do this, you need to do that. I wasn't hearing any of that. Selfish and self-centered, running my own deal right from the get-go. That's just the way it was. I mean, and I think those are some of the traits that make up the alcoholic even before you get into the heavy drinking or you even take the first drink. I remember stealing money out of my dad's wallet when I was like 10, 11, 12 years old. Normal kids, I don't think, do that, you know? So at 18, I moved out to Houston, Texas, and when I went out to Texas, I didn't have any friends, didn't know anybody, nothing like that. Started frequenting some places, and I started drinking, and that's really where my drinking took off. I learned how to drink in Texas. That's all I can say. You know, there's not wasn't much to do out there, you know, and it was progressive. It didn't start off with a half gallon of vodka. It started off with draining the liquor cabinet, then getting I took a hostage. Her name was Megan. She was 4 years older than I was, and she bought me all the booze I wanted, and I got to tell you something, I was in love because she bought me all the booze I wanted. Never complained, never said anything until it got towards the end of the relationship. So for about two and a half years, something like that, you know, I'm drinking a fifth of vodka a day. I was a functioning alcoholic for a little while. little while. Not a long time, because some people get in here in their 40s and 50s and they were functioning for 10, 20 years, something like that. But I did it for about 3-4 years. I was able to go to work, drink half a fifth, go to work, have the bottle in the car, take a smoke break, and a drink break at the same time, and kind of go about my day. And I never really had any consequences, per se, from my drinking. Got called into the office a couple times saying, hey, you know, you've been drinking, we smell it on you, blah, blah, blah. Never really had any consequences. At about 3.5 years of being out there, first off, I despised being out there. I was living in Houston. It was, you know, hot, muggy, and nasty. If anyone's ever been there, it's not exactly the loveliest city on, you know, in the United States. But so at about 3.5 years, relationships started going south. Things were starting to get a little heavy due to the work and because of my drinking and everything like that. They were starting to come on to me a little bit. So I made the decision, you know what? It's not working here. Texas is the problem. She's the problem. The job's the problem. I'm moving back to California. So that's my geographic story right there in itself. I moved back to California thinking that that was going to solve the drinking, that was going to solve everything. I was going to go back to school. I was going to get an apartment, get the car, get the house, whatever. Thought that was going to fix it. I get back out to California and the opposite kind of happened. Because I didn't have that babysitter anymore. I didn't really have that job that, you know, they were watching me anymore. So I took off. I went from a fifth to a half gallon. And within a year of being back out in California, I found myself in a room in an apartment in Costa Mesa. Eyes were yellow. Skin was yellow. Blood coming out of every orifice. Not to get too graphic. And you know, not wanting to live. Basically wanting to die, but not having the guts to kill myself. When you read the doctor's opinion in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the first type they talk about is the hopeless type. You know, I relate to that. When I read the doctor's opinion, it's one of the first things my sponsor had me do is read the doctor's opinion and see what you identify with in the doctor's opinion. There's about 17 different types. If you really break it down, there's about 17 different types of alcoholics, and I identify with every single one of them in the doctor's opinion. You know, I'm hopeless. I've tried other methods. I've tried, you know, switching from Smirnoff to Barton's. That didn't work. Tried, you know, just drinking beer and laying off the hard stuff. I hate beer. I never got beer. The only reason time I drank beer is for, you know, social reasons only. I like room temperature, preferably warm vodka. If you've ever had it in the car and you go out there in the afternoon on like a hot summer day and you pull it out of there, it's about 90 degrees. The first one's pretty bad. But that's just how I roll. That's just how it went. You know, I thought that was normal. At the end of my drinking, what I used to do is I'd get a bottle of water, I'd pour all the water out, I'd fill the water bottle up with water or with vodka, and I'd take that kind of with me about the day, and I'm thinking to myself this whole time, I was like, man, why doesn't everyone else do this? This is a freaking great idea. You know what I mean? So in September of 2005, a bunch of circumstances happened, and they were all due to my drinking. I was sitting in my apartment, I think it was a Tuesday afternoon, big drinking day, by the way. Tuesdays were huge. It was like a Tuesday afternoon. I think I had to work, and I called in sick to work or something along those lines. I'd gone to the liquor store, got a fifth of vodka, pounded that, and I was sitting in the apartment. I was like, you know what, I think I want to go down and shoot some pool today. There was this pool, it was a lovely establishment down in Newport Beach called Goat Hill Tavern. If anyone's ever heard of it, it's right next to the Helm. So did a lot of crazy stuff there. So I was down at the Goat Hill Tavern. I'm shooting some pool. 3-4 o'clock rolls around. I'm starting to lose my buzz a little bit. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to try this water bottle thing in the tavern, and hopefully this will all work out pretty good. So, and it did. Went and got a fifth. You know, brought my water bottle in, kind of hit it. You know, everything like that. Drank that whole thing. It started to get late at night. A couple people came in. They're like, hey, do you smoke? I go, yeah, sure, why not? And I didn't smoke pot. I'm like, 6 months, 7 months, 8 months, something like that, almost a year. I don't even remember because it's all kind of pretty much 2005 and 2006. I don't remember a whole lot of stuff, so I'm doing my best to recall my story here. So, you know, we do that, and then I come back in, I get a pitcher of beer. Once again, I don't even like beer. It's for social reasons only. You know, midnight, 1 o'clock rolls around, and I got to go home. And the first thought that comes to my mind, this is a Tuesday night, by the way, is there's way too many cops on Harbor Boulevard. I'm not going to go down Harbor. Okay? Because I'm pretty drunk. I'm not going to go down Harbor Boulevard. So I decide to take the freeway. I get on the 55. I'm headed up to 55, and I am hammered. I do not know where I'm at. To this day, I still do not know exactly where I was, but I ended up wrapping my truck around a telephone pole going about 55 miles an hour. All I remember from that instance really is the airbag deploying. You know, after the car stopped, you see all the dust and everything like that from the airbag. That's really all I remember. The first thing that came to my mind was I need to get the bottle that's in the back of the car out of the car just in case. And as I go to do so, I fall out of the car. So, you know, the cops came 3 minutes later. I got arrested, took me to jail, you know, what have you. That's the first instance. That's the first time that I thought to myself that I might, just might, maybe, possibly, perhaps, have a problem with alcohol. People had been telling me for years, you need to slow down. You need to, you know, ease up a little bit. You need to, you know, lay off the hard stuff. Try some more controlled drinking. You know, that none of that stuff ever sticks. So that was the first instance I thought I might have a problem with alcoholism. That was not the day I got sober. It was not the day I got sober. On October 16th of 2006, the roommate I was living with at the time, basically for the next 20 days, I locked myself in my room in the apartment, and I drank myself just absolutely into oblivion all day, every day, all night. I lost a job, you know, didn't show up. All that stuff just kind of fell apart. I didn't really have a care in the world. The only care that came to my mind was getting that next drink. That's all I thought about was getting that next drink. It's really all I thought about for years, but especially in those last 20 days, that's all I could do. It's absolutely all I could do. So on October 16th, 2006, she came into my room. She said, look, I can't watch you kill yourself anymore. I'm going to take you somewhere where you can get help. And my first reaction to that was, I'm fine. I don't need it. I'm okay. I'm good. She goes, well, you can't live here anymore, so either you're going to be homeless or you're going to go to this place. So I ended up getting into the car with her, and as we're driving down Harbor Boulevard towards Charlie Street, I'm thinking to myself, and I'm looking around. I'm actually looking at the shrubbery in and around the Costa Mesa area because it almost seemed like a better idea than getting sober. I did not want to be here when I got here. And she drove me into Charlie Street. She, you know, we walked up the sidewalk into the house, and as I walked in the house, I walked into the office. I remember this. I had two pairs of pants and two shirts to my name. It's all I owned. Everything I had of value, I pawned or hawked or sold or what have you. All I had was two pairs of pants and two shirts to my name. And I walked in the office, and I set those down on the table, and there was a man sitting in the chair, and he looked up at me and said, who are you? I said, my name's Lee. He said, why are you here? I said, I don't know. He said, okay, sit down. And he talked to me for a little while. He asked me about my drinking, you know, asked me what I was doing. And I, for the first time, I kind of pretty much told him the truth. At least I think I did. I'd have to get the story from him because he knows it probably a lot better than I do. But he said I was honest, and he did say that I needed help. I remember saying that I needed help. And what he had me do, the house was full when I got there. And if anyone doesn't know what Charlie Street is, it's a low-bottom men's indigent detox down in Costa Mesa. It's been around since 1952. They're going on 61 years, and we call it God's house. It's a house of miracles. It's just a beautiful thing to be a part of. And when I went into the office, the detox was full. They didn't have any room for me, so he told me, and his name's Kevin, who's also my sponsor, Kevin Yarder. I don't know if I think he spoke here not too long ago. But he told me, go out in the day room. There's a meeting about to start. And I went out to the day room, and there's these ugly orange tables right in the middle of the day room. And I sat at the end of one of the orange tables. And, you know, if anyone drinks like I do, usually the key to successful drinking is you don't eat. So I hadn't eaten in about 3-4 days. And I sat at those orange tables, and I remember there was a guy that came up to me, and it was a guy that was in the house. He was in the detox for those 10 days, and he walks up to me and goes, have you eaten anything? I said, no, I haven't eaten in days. He said, okay, you can have my dinner. And this is a guy that was in the detox. He'd maybe been there 3-4 days. And he brought a plate over, and I had some dinner. After that, the meeting started. You know, I'd never been to AA before, never been to a meeting before, didn't know what AA was. I was a blank page, didn't really have any preconceived notion of what it was. If you asked me the day I got here what AA was, I said it's something that's going to teach me how to not drink anymore. You know, later on I find out it's so much more. But I sat at those tables and the meeting started and the men got their hands up and they started to share. And what they were sharing is they were sharing my story. Every single share I heard in that meeting, and maybe for the first time in my whole life, my eyes and my ears were open, and I heard the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard about people that were doing the same things I was doing, living the same way I was living, and they weren't doing those things anymore. And they seemed happy. They were smiling. They were laughing. I hadn't laughed or smiled or any of that in a really long, long time. You know, in the book it talks about the first step. We get the step one in how it works in chapter 5. But also in chapter 3 it says we fully conceded to our innermost selves that we're alcoholics. You know, that happened to me that night when I was at Charlie Street at those orange tables. My sobriety date's October 17th of 2006. I haven't had a drink since that day. You know, after the meeting, they called me back into the office. They asked me what I wanted to do. I said, I think I'm in the right place. I need help. I ended up going down to a sober living home down in Mission Viejo, California. That's where I detoxed, and that's where I got sober. The night I was at Charlie Street, I was appointed a sponsor. I didn't get the opportunity to go sponsor shopping or anything like that. Kevin, who is now my sponsor, pointed at a guy in the room. His name is Sean Brunel, and said, he's your sponsor. And I said, what's that? It was my first reaction, because I thought a sponsor was someone that's going to, like, you know, buy you a car, get you a house, you know, get you all this stuff. Like a sponsor, you know, like if you're a skateboarder and you get sponsored, right? You know, that's what I thought a sponsor was. I had no idea. If I knew it was someone that was going to tell me what to do and give me direction and stuff like that, I wouldn't have got one. I would have said no. But, you know, I'm grateful that he did that, because I probably wouldn't have the courage, because I was so full of fear when I got here, I wouldn't have the courage to really ask anyone for help. You know, and that sponsor had me write, he had me write the Serenity Prayer in the back of the big book. He had me write my name, my sobriety date, and he told me I needed to get a home group. My home group is the CDM Soup Kitchen Minstag, Costa Mesa, California. It's been my home group ever since I've been sober. The only time I missed that meeting is if I'm basically 3,000 miles away. I'm always there. You know where to find me on a Tuesday night. If I owe you money, you can find me at the soup kitchen meeting on Tuesday nights. That's a guarantee. You know, I love that group. I've been a part of that group for ever since I've been sober, and it's a big part of my sobriety as well. When I first got sober, I'd lost a job when I was drinking, and then I got another job pretty much the day after, and I was still drinking at the time, so I didn't even know how that happened. And it was down in Mission Viejo, and I remember going to the house. I was detoxed, and I shaked and baked for about 3-4 days. And after that, I went back to work, and when I went back to work, I got honest with them. I told them the truth. I said, hey, this is what's going on. I'm trying to get sober. I have a problem with alcoholism. You know, this is the deal. Now, I didn't run that by anybody. I probably should have ran that by a sponsor, but it was probably a bad idea. But it actually got, you know, widespread approval, you know, kind of like it says in the first 164. It got widespread approval. They said, you know what, that's great. You should have told us. We could have helped you. You still have a job. You just need to show up and you need to not drink. I said, okay, I think I can manage that for the most part. I ended up keeping that job, and I kept that job for 10 months. Part of my story is, you know, I started with step one really happened for me. Thank you. Step one happened for me when I was sitting at Charlie Street at those tables. When I fully conceded to my innermost self that I was alcoholic, and I knew my life was unmanageable. If you're walking into a low-bottoms men's indigent detox facility with two pairs of pants and two shirts to your name, and you're checking out the shrubbery on your way there, your life is unmanageable. That's just the facts. At least it is for me, you know. Step one, easy. Easy for me. There was no further research. There was no further convincing. I was powerless over alcohol. I couldn't not drink. I had to drink. It was a necessity. Like Bill talks about in his story, you know, it became a necessity. It was no longer a luxury, you know. So my sponsor, Sean, started taking me through the steps. You know, in steps two and three, he had me, you know, kind of describe to him and tell him, you know, what's God? You know, what do you turn your will and your life over to? You know, sanity. I'm insane when it comes to booze. I'm also insane in a lot of other areas. You know, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Took a little while for me. I didn't have any kind of religious training or religious education or spiritual education or anything like that when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. So, once again, I was a blank page in all those areas. When reading the big book, the way it describes it in the big book a little bit is, you know, we ask for help and then accept the help that's offered. For me, when I was new, to keep it really, really simple, you know, I leaned on that sponsor and other people in Alcoholics Anonymous as my higher power. You know, If I had something going on, I had five people in my life that had my best interest in mind, and I could run that same thing by those five people and get the same answer back from every single one of them, that's my answer from God through them to me. And that's how simple it was. And that's how simple it still is a lot of times with the things that happen in my life. My sponsor told me about, you know, prayer and meditation. He had me memorize a few prayers. He had me memorize the third step prayer. He had me memorize the seventh step prayer. He also had me try to memorize the 11th step prayer, which I still haven't got down. It's a long one, you know? And, you know, that kind of helped me make my beginning. When things got, I want to say, difficult for me, and it was mentioned earlier before, was when it came down to the inventory process. You know, and writing down all that stuff, you know, that happened throughout my drinking career. A lot of stuff that I was ashamed of, a lot of stuff that I didn't, I thought I would take to the grave with me, a lot of stuff that I thought I'd never tell another person in my entire life. You know? I'm blessed and I'm grateful that God gave me the ability to be as honest as I could through my first inventory. I've worked probably 7 or 8, maybe 9 inventories since I've been sober on different topics, different subject matter, even different people. You know, and that's the part of step 10. It's a continuous process. It's a continual growth process. You know, when I took that my first inventory, when I took it to my sponsor, he basically just listened. He didn't really say a whole lot. He pulled out some character defects. We talked about it a little bit, but at the end of it, he said something, and I remembered this emphatically. He said, "I forgive you, and God forgives you, and you don't ever have to live like that again." And when he said that to me, at the end of me reading, you know, all this gross shit that I put down on paper, I started to well up in tears a little bit. Now, it talks about sometimes that an impact, or you'll feel something at once after you take a fifth step. I got emotional, but it kind of got blotted out a little bit because I really didn't feel a change. I really didn't feel any different. You know, when I got into 6 and 7 and exercised a little bit of humility, things started to change for me a little bit, but the real change happened in steps 8 and 9, which was mentioned earlier, through the amends process. Because I had to go back to a lot of those people that I had screwed over, that I had caused harm to, that I was resentful towards, that I was afraid of, that, you know, I had to go back to those people and I had to sit down with them and have an honest talk with them. And that, you know, for me, in the amends, the two biggest amends I had on my list were to my father and to my sister. And the hardest amends I had to do was to my father. Because I put that man through literal hell. I really did. I'd stolen from him, screwed him over, disrespected his home on numerous occasions. I'd done a lot of really, really shady stuff to him. You know, when I sat down with him and made my amends, our relationship changed. Our relationship changed. My dad's one of my best friends, you know, in my life today. And, you know, my sponsor says this, and I love it when he puts it like this. He says, you know, you have one of your original sponsors back in your life today. You know, and I didn't really know what that meant, you know, because this is a man that loved me dearly, that wanted the best for me, that always wanted, you know, nothing but the best for me, but I never was willing to listen to him. I can pick up the phone today and call my father and get, you know, I'm blessed because I have the ability. If he says something to me or we're having a conversation back and forth, I can listen and maybe actually follow his advice. It's amazing, you know. You know, I think I've probably only got about 5 minutes left, so I'm going to kind of wrap it up a little bit. You know, another part of my story is this. My parents divorced when I was young. I was about 8 years old. My parents got divorced. I didn't talk to my mom from the ages of 8 to 22 years old. So that brings up a lot of abandonment issues and different things like that. And, you know, I won't get into all that because I could spend a half an hour just talking about that subject alone. But when I was about a year and a half sober, I went out to my grandmother's house, met my sister, my mom, her husband, and kind of reunited the family. And that's when I made the amends with her. One of the miracles of this program is having the ability to do those things. I was afraid to do it. I have a lot of fear. I'm a fear-based person. And when I made those things, I have an outstanding relationship with my mom today. I have a great relationship with my dad today. Great. I'm a good son. I'm a good brother. I'm a good friend. I'm a good employee. And I learned all that stuff here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know how to do any of that stuff left to my own devices. I would have screwed it up. I'm selfish and self-centered to the core. You know? But the book tells me I need to be rid of this selfishness. I must, or it kills me. It kills us. And that's the truth. It's a tedious process. It takes a long, long time. What I've found, and this comes, you know, and you can say 10 and 11 and 12 or just in 12 alone, spiritual principle behind step 12 for me is love and service. The more I give, the more I give back, the more I do for others, the better my life gets, the happier I am. I always thought it was the other way around. I had it skewed because I thought the more I did for me, the better my life was going to get. And I was wrong. Because the more I do for others, when I go down to Charlie Street and I sit down with a newcomer, I sit down with another alcoholic and share my experience and listen, be a good listener and hear their experience, and we have a good conversation, I can leave there feeling good, they're feeling good, and it's a miracle. I don't know how that happens. Bill and Bob are on to something, man. You know? And, you know, if I say anything today, I just got to say this, and this is mainly for the newcomers. I love being sober today. I love being sober today. I would rather chop my arm off than take another drink. There's a set of promises that are in the big book. It comes, I sometimes read it in the mornings between pages 84 and 88. It's the 10-step promises. A lot of times you hear in meeting the 9-step promises. Talk about fear of financial insecurity will leave us, you know, all that kind of stuff. There's a set of promises in the big book behind the 10th step that says we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protective. We haven't sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. And what they're referring to is booze, obviously. Okay? You know, that has happened for me. It has happened for me. And that's my hope for anyone who's new in the program is to have that happen to you. Like I said, you never have to take a drink again, even if you want to. It's crazy how that works. You know, I still suffer from alcoholism today. I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to have alcoholism till the day I die. What I have recovered from is a hopeless condition of mind and body. I'm no longer hopeless today. I have a sound mind, a clear heart, a clear head, and my life is really, really good from the inside out. So if you're new in these rooms, welcome. Welcome to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. My best suggestion would be to find someone that has a working knowledge of the big book to take you through the 12 steps. You work the first 11 steps. You have a spiritual awakening when you get to step 12. You never have to take a drink. Thank you very much. All right, ladies and gentlemen.